when all the people who were involved in the struggle are prevented from being involved in the struggle because they're faced with possibly being expelled from the university. Now, I don't think that's amnesty. I don't even think that's partial amnesty.
That was the voice of a young Juan Gonzalez, now heard on Pacifica Radio as co-host of Democracy Now!, back in April of 1968 during a student protest that virtually paralyzed New York's Columbia University and garnered international headlines. And that's this week's subject on From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly program that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Hello, I'm Brian DeShazer, the director of the archives, and we're pleased to help mark the 40th anniversary of this watershed historic event that even the 1969 World Almanac lists as perhaps the most notable in a wave of college disruptions. Like the crackle at the center of a firestorm, students at Columbia University in New York City intensified the anti-Vietnam War movement on April 23, 1968, by starting a revolt against the school administration, seizing campus buildings, and barricading themselves for days. Eventually, the police moved in with military-style force, injuring 140 and arresting more than 700 participants. Before we listen to the rest of the sounds from Pacifica's coverage of the events, we have with us today one of the 700 student protesters who were arrested. Barbara Bernstein is an award-winning veteran independent radio producer. She has been producing documentary series that have aired around the world for the past 25 years, in various venues such as the BBC and on programs such as Outright Radio and here on Pacifica Radio. She lives in Portland, Oregon, and can be heard on Pacifica affiliate station KBOO. Barbara is also a participant in the upcoming 40th reunion next week in New York City. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
You know, you were arrested in the President's Building at Columbia University almost 40 years ago. I know it's a complex issue, but can you describe what it was all about and what your experience was?
That's a pretty big question.
It's huge. Well,
actually, what it was about specifically, I think it was about three things. One was about the war in Vietnam, which was represented on campus by a thing called the Institute for Defense Analysis, which was basically doing war research and feeding the government some of the nefarious plans that they were instituting in Vietnam. And it was like Columbia faculty were involved. The second thing was racism, and that was symbolized by this gym that the university wanted to build in Morningside Park, and basically taking over parkland, which would be even more horrible today in a lot of people's eyes, by taking over parkland that was city-owned and having it be a university gym for university people. But then to add insult to injury, they were going to have a basement entrance where members of the Harlem community could come in from the lower level, because Morningside Park is a very steep hill, and at the bottom of the hill is Harlem. So the Harlem community could come in through the back door on the lower level and use the apartheid facilities that the university was going to provide for them. And then the third thing, I think, had to do with student autonomy and the fact that we felt like we were thinking intelligent human beings who should have some control over our own lives and were tied to the paternalism of the university.
During the era back in 1968, you know, the media was changing, the world was changing, so many events had happened. By this time, Dr. King had just been assassinated less than 3 weeks previous to that. Students in Berkeley had been, you know, protesting and rallying for most of the year. So this really is seen, you know, I checked out my 1969 World Almanac, and it really has, yeah, again, a great complexity of descriptions on what this was about. So what was your individual experience in deciding to go into the President's Building?
Well, to back up a little bit, we started out the strike going into Hamilton Hall, which is the center of Columbia College. And that was kind of an afterthought. There was a demonstration planned that day because a number of students were being threatened with suspension or expulsion because they had protested inside Lowe Library, which is the President's office, the whole administration center is Lowe Library. And they had protested inside there. There was rules against indoor protests, and so they were going to be thrown out of school. They were called the IDA 6 because they're protesting against the Institute for Defense Analysis as president on the university campus. So there was this big event, big rally was called for April 23rd at noon on the Sundial, which is the central gathering place on the campus, to have a protest. And the plan was to go march into Lowe Library again, but it was barricaded by campus security. And so people instead decided to get down to the gym site on Morningside Park, and there was a kind of a scuffle there. People tried to tear down the fence. One person was arrested, and then people went back to campus, and then I don't know whose idea it was. Probably, it might have been Mark Rudd's, I'm not sure, but somebody said, let's take over Hamilton Hall, and that was the beginning of that. Actually, my own experience, I slept in that morning, so I didn't make it down at noon for the Sundial rally. So I was actually walking up Amsterdam Avenue as people were coming back from the park, and I got caught up in the whole event as people were returning to campus, and I was one of the people that entered Hamilton Hall. And once we were there, I guess we realized we had occupied it, and we sort of inadvertently held the dean of students hostage for, I think, about 24 hours as well. Late that night, or early the following morning, the black students, who we were kind of, there was an alliance between the Student Afro-American Society and SDS, and it was kind of a unusual and I think sort of tenuous alliance of black and white students, basically.
Right.
The black students decided to throw us out of Hamilton Hall. They didn't think we were serious enough. And at that point, a group of us went over and took over Lowell Library, and that was the beginning of occupying eventually five buildings.
Well, and how long were you in the building itself? Were you for 3 days, 4 days?
Lowell Library. I was in there for a few hours in the morning. It would have been Wednesday morning. And then there was a rumors, actually the cops came in, and I panicked like a lot of people, and I climbed out the window. And then we had meetings on campus all that day, and then that night I decided to re-enter the building with a bunch of people. So I was basically in the building for just about 6 days. And there were 125 of us in the building. It was like three rooms, one bathroom, a makeshift kitchen in the center of the president's office. People were making peanut butter sandwiches there nonstop, and it was very tight living quarters. It was a very intense communal experience. It was also like nonstop political meetings and political education for 6 days.
You know, as we've been working on our 1968 Preservation and Access Project here in the Pacifica Archives, you know, Pacifica was the only independent radio network that was alive at the time in 1968, predating NPR and PBS. And what's extraordinary in listening to the sounds and the coverage that we have is the variety of reportage from in-studio, interviews with Mark Rudd, as you mentioned before, Juan Gonzalez and other participants and leaders of the organizations behind it, and also the actuality in the streets. You know, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, in 1968, media was changing, technology was changing, and also this insurgence of college and even high school students sort of raising their voices, and this being one of the main events that sort of is marked and was noticed, you know, as the one of the sayings is the whole world was watching. What do you think in terms of, you know, looking back and listening to some of the audio as you've been working with on this 40th reunion, what do you hear in those sounds, and why do you think these recordings are important to preserve?
Well, you know, what I hear is this immense passion, a real core feeling on the part, and I remember when I hear our voices, I remember that feeling of feeling so committed to really trying to end the war in Vietnam and to really work for social justice in this country. And I think that when you're young and you're in college, and I was 19 when I was involved with the Columbia strike, you have everything is possible. And I think that's one of the things that kind of permeated the late 60s and early 70s. We believed anything was possible. We could do anything, and the revolution was around the corner. And when you really believe that, you'll do anything. And while some people did a lot more than I felt comfortable with, actually, to make that kind of social change. The Sorbonne students started striking. Like, I think we were in the buildings when they started their street demonstrations. And one of the early signs was create 2-3 many Columbias. And so we were very proud of that. But I think that there was actually a much headier feeling in those days about making headlines around the world because it was a harder thing to do. And we were very aware that what was going on was like really, that we knew we were making history. We knew that we hoped we were making revolution. We really saw this as like, I mean, because it was also, there was so much media there. That's the other part of it, is you could tell that you were in the news because of the international media that was on campus every day. Life magazine ran a spread right after the bust and showed all these students in the library, and this is when the poet David Shapiro was smoking a cigar, stretching his feet against up against Grayson Kirk's desk, and it, I mean, that became an iconic photograph. But the fact is that Life magazine was inside the building photographing us in the early morning of us taking over the president's office. But I think the way we put our bodies on the line, I mean, I still have the scar on my head from being bashed by the cops when we were arrested on April 30th, and some other people, I think, carry much worse scars than that. The cops were really brutal. We were really putting ourselves down and like just accepting what was ever, you know, whatever the consequences were, because we believed so strongly that this was the way to stop the war. And I know that the whole year I had been wandering around the city of New York going to lots of demonstrations and thinking nonstop, how do we end the war? How do we end the war? And, you know, as an 18 and 19 year old, feeling this incredible responsibility that we had to end the war. Another thing that was very different for college students then than now is that, I mean, one of the consequences of participating in the strike was the threat of being expelled from school. Well, for the male students, being expelled from school meant that they lost their 1A status and they could wind up in Vietnam. So, I mean, it was like, I think the war was a lot closer to a lot of us then than the Iraq war is to people here now in the United States. And that really motivated us to do what we did. And I marvel at it now. I look back and I'm sort of looking to see, like, where is that kind of energy and activism? And actually, I think I do see it now. And interestingly, there's going to be a series of demonstrations on the Columbia campus sponsored by a group of graduate students starting on April 24th, protesting the school's involvement in the Iraq War. So things don't change in a way. Maybe they just get better.
We're talking with Barbara Bernstein, who was one of the student protesters while we're looking back at Columbia University strike almost 40 years ago. Barbara, you're involved with the 40th reunion coming up this coming weekend. Tell us how you're involved and what you hope to expect to hear there.
Well, actually, I got involved. I'm not one of the organizers, and I only found out about it last fall. I think I actually heard rumblings about it last spring. But last fall, I started getting emails from old friends telling me about it. So there's a listserv, a Yahoo group, that had gotten started, and I joined that, and being kind of a blabbermouth on listservs, I got really kind of vocal on the listserv, and then got connected with some of my old friends who have roped me into doing a couple things. So one thing I'm going to be doing actually is recording as much of the event as I possibly can, and we'll be broadcasting that, I think, on Pacifica later on in the spring. And I'm also participating in a panel. Well, it's not exactly a panel. It's more like a multimedia event on Friday night at 8 o'clock is called What Happened? It's at the Law School of Columbia, and it's described on the website as a large-scale multimedia narrative of the events at Columbia in the spring of 1968, told by witnesses and participants on as many sides and from many points of views as possible. And then they list a lot of the leadership, both of this coming event and also people who were leadership back in 1968. And then what they don't mention is a whole lot of us that have been recruited to also tell our own stories and to kind of give a very personal touch to what our experiences were in the different buildings that we occupied. But there's going to be a lot of other, I mean, a couple of things that I'm very excited about. One is on Saturday morning at 10 a.m., there's a panel, The Legacy of the Student Movement, and it's moderated by Pacifica's own Juan Gonzalez and Lewis Cole, who's now professor of film at Columbia University. He was a leader at Columbia SDS back in 1968 and onward. And then they'll also have the controversial Todd Gitlin, Morris Isserman, who is at Hamilton College and was not actually a participant in Columbia strike, but I knew him very well in Portland. He lived in Portland and was involved with the PSU strike in 1970 here. Peniel Joseph, John McMillan, and Francis Fox Piven will all be talking about sort of what did we do, what came out of our student movement, and how is it relevant today. There's also going to be a gathering of students then and now that's going to be, I think it's also Saturday, and there'll be an opportunity for current student activists to get a chance to talk over strategy, tactics, philosophy with some of us old codgers from 1968 and maybe see what we have to learn from each other. And then Saturday night, there's going to be a reading of writers who were involved with the strike in 68, and they'll be reading their works about the strike and also works that just came out of that time.
The website where a lot of this information can be reviewed is at columbia1968.info. And also you can visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org. You know, as part of our 1968 Preservation and Access Project, you know, we preserve these materials, digitized them, and made them available to the reunion protesters to use on their website. So you'll also see a little link from the Pacifica Radio Archives on there. Barbara Bernstein, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experience and your work in radio. We really appreciate it. And hope to hear some of that broadcast when you come back from the reunion.
Sure,
and
well,
thank you so much.
I'm looking forward to producing an hour documentary about all of this.
Well, we'll definitely play some of it, that's for sure, here on From the Vault, and we hope that we can archive it and preserve those recordings for the future generations.
Scheming, Uno Mundo, isn't he reading? Uno Mundo. same.
And now to some of those passionate voices Barbara spoke about. Pacifica radio station WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City brought the events to its listeners not only by broadcasting campus-organized press conferences and official university statements, but by being in the crowd and allowing the voices of the students to tell their story themselves. You will also hear the rallies in the days after the unrest and interviews with various students and student leaders.
On tonight's special report, WBAI presents Radicalization at Columbia. This is Bob Murphy for WBAI News. In the 1930s, a student strike was led by leftist groups at City College in New York. It was not overly successful. But now, Columbia and Berkeley have pointed the way to a new kind of student radicalization. Last night, the continuing scene at Columbia featured a march across the 116th Street Walk and a threat to take over more buildings today. Last night also, the major wire services and several stations reported that there was an impending police raid at Columbia and that several hundred students, had taken over Skirmerhorn Hall. The report was false. Student groups held an orderly demonstration on campus today, which included a surprise appearance from Columbia's president. Campus members from Students for a Restructured University and SDS were holding a joint rally after the two groups decided to join together on at least two issues: a demand for amnesty for all students and the dropping of charges against all students resulting from last May's student demonstrations. Today's rally came as reports circulated on campus that the administration was planning to revoke the school's charter for SDS because of their demonstration yesterday, which resulted in the calling off of scheduled student registration. Members of SDS had tried to enter the registration building. Many of them were suspended during the campus protest last May, demanding that they too be allowed to register. The Columbia situation has grown even more intense for one particular reason. The SDS group has tried to get the incoming freshmen. Last night, as you'll hear in a few minutes, members of SDS went to the freshman dormitories and talked with the incoming students to let them know the SDS side of the story, and also to try to rally support. During today's protest, Columbia's president, Cordier, addressed the students, receiving neither a warm nor a cool reception, but mainly one of surprise, since the students didn't expect to see him. But he was there anyway and told them what they already knew: that the school is faced with many problems as the new semester opens.
9:30 p.m., Wednesday night, Columbia campus is very quiet except for a small group gathered in front of Skirmerhorn Hall. This is the hall which houses the geology department, the anthropology departments, and several other departments of the university, as well as many teaching classrooms.
Well, among other things, the news press, CBS, WINS, and I don't know, another couple of other stations, have declared tonight that we've liberated Skirmerhorn Hall, and they said we've barricaded the doors, and 310 radical students have taken a building, which is obviously not true. You're standing right here in a very free building with an open door downstairs.
There are no barricades here, and everybody's permitted to enter.
Also, we found out that Proctor Khan, the proctor of the university, went on to a freshman orientation program tonight in another building wearing a crash helmet, saying that this building had indeed been taken over, and it obviously hasn't. So it's just there's some mechanism going, saying that we've occupied a building when actually you can see that we haven't.
I'm in the hall where the meeting is going on right now.
The slogan "student power" in these two meetings. First, student power as a global demand for student determination of their own cultural and professional formation. This is because this autonomous determination has no possibility at all to act upon the capitalist labor market. That is, it cannot create new occupational positions and certainly does not change the capitalist relationships of production and thus the division of labor in which the student is inserted. The problem of power can be posed in a realistic fashion only at the level of the general structures of society. To put at an end student power means to avoid the necessity of a total change in which all exploited people can be freed. Secondly, student power has to be rejected in its meaning of an organization within the school, of a rebellion movement, and of a confrontation permanently opposed to the official power structure. This is because it is a struggle which does not give power, and it is not an objective which perpetuates the laws, and it is an objective which perpetuates the law of the capitalistic social organization, that is, to train the future technicians to be in this society the good officers of exploitation.
Time is 12:10. There's a very large group of people coming onto the Columbia campus from the east side of Broadway through the 116th Street entrance. They have linked arms. They are students, mostly. There's a gentleman parading a red flag in front of them, another one with a blue flag and the white insignia on it, which I can't make out. No, the other side is black. They have come in quite suddenly. There are close to 1,000 students. Where do these students come from all of a sudden?
From the campus to Cordier's residence on Morningside Drive, then to the School of International Affairs. We were shouting, SIA, must go. Now we're going back onto the campus, and we're going into the dormitories to talk to the freshmen, try and convince them to come over, you know, join with us, you know, in whatever actions are being planned tomorrow and for the rest of the year. Right?
I see. This whole group then had marched to Cordier's office?
No, his house. They were the Columbia University president's residence, 116th Street, Morningside Drive, to the School of International Affairs, shouting all the time our slogans, hey, hey, Cordier, assassin for the CIA, SIA must go. And now we're back on the campus.
What time did you march over to Cordier's house?
What time is it now?
It's at 12:10.
Well, it was then 12:15.
You know. I see. Did you proceed from Schermerhorn?
From Schermerhorn, we went into the main part of the campus near the sundial, over to Hartley and Livingston, over to Ferris Booth and Fernald, and then back over to Amsterdam Avenue to Morningside Drive.
There is now a large meeting at the sundial, which is the center of the Columbia campus at 116th Street.
tomorrow at 10 a.m. we'll hold a mass meeting. It was originally scheduled as an SDS General Assembly, but we'd like to hold a mass meeting.
This is Mark Rudd speaking.
At 10 a.m. concerning the SDS, the revocation of the SDS charter, also what we're going to do about it, and where we're going to go from here. That'll be in front of Earl Hall, because we can't get any rooms anymore. Tomorrow, 10 a.m., front of Earl Hall. 12 o'clock, 12 noon, SRU and some other groups are holding a rally in support of SDS. Here, a rally called by SRU in support of SDS. We ask everybody to come, to join with our brothers and our cousins in the struggle. Tonight was the first meeting of the International Assembly of Revolutionary Students. We felt it was a great success. We're going to continue tomorrow, the second of 5 days, here at 2 p.m. in front of Ferris Booth Hall. We invite everybody, freshmen, everybody, in front of Ferris Booth Hall. Tomorrow night, we'll have the plenary session of the International Assembly on the campus movements, or on the student movement on campus. At 8 p.m., we'll meet here, and then we'll go to the room. Whatever room we decide to go to, we'll go to that one.
Fuck the SS!
Just a couple of closing words. Remember in Chicago, when young people were being beaten on the streets by cops, they were chanting, "The whole world is watching, the whole world is watching." Well, right now, across this country and in countries around the world, young people, students and non-students, oppressed people, and people in advanced industrial countries are watching. The message from the Venezuelan students tonight shows us that our movement is important throughout the world. We're going to read you the message from the Venezuelan students. Would the press turn on their lights so we can read? This is a statement from the Political Commission of the National Command of the Left-Wing Revolutionary Movement of Venezuela. On his own name and on behalf of all our militants, we send a combative greetings to the Congress of the Colombia Strike Coordinating Committee and to all the organizations invited. These greetings are especially sent on behalf of the militants who are now fighting in the cities and in the mountains of our countries against the imperialist domination. For us, the student actions of Columbia and Berkeley University and the hard struggle of the Black Panthers, SNCC, SDS, and others in the United States against the racist imperialist structure that oppresses the Afro-American people are a very important contribution to the anti-imperialist struggle and especially for the development of our fight to the achievement of national liberation. We are quite sure that the combination of the anti-imperialist struggle in and outside of the USA will precipitate the final defeat of American imperialism. Your struggle, together with the fight of the Vietnamese people, both are an extraordinary support for the revolutionary combatants and for the people of Latin America. Dear comrades, you can be sure that our party and other Venezuelan revolutionaries will have no compromises with reactionaries and imperialist forces. We'll maintain and develop the armed struggle as the only way to achieve national liberation and the liquidation of imperialism in our country. We wish you many successes in your constructive work and in the fulfillment of your tasks. Long live the struggle of the American people. Long live the struggle of the Vietnamese people. Long live the Cuban Revolution. Long live Venezuela. Down with racist exploitation.
You are listening to the sounds from the 1968 Columbia University Student Revolt on From the Vault. For a copy of this program or for information, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us at 1-800-735-0230.
This is Juan Gonzalez talking right now.
That it will not revoke SDS as it would like. Now we want to go into the dorms with all of you, with some of you who may not agree with a lot of what we've been saying here, who have questions, who support us, who want to know more. Let's go to the dorms. Let's talk quietly in small groups. We'll be there, and everyone in Livingston Lobby, Inferno Lobby, and Carmen Lobby. We'll be there, and we'll talk about the issues involved, and we'll talk about where this country is going, and where this university is going, and what it's doing in this society, and what we would like it to do, and what we would, and how we would like to exchange with you our ideas over it. Come join us now.
Excuse me, why was SDS's charter revoked, and when did this happen?
Oh, it happened, what's this?
BAI.
Oh, it was revoked because of the thing that happened today, where they went into the registration, you know, and they wanted to register, I think, 30 people who, you know, for the most, I guess, the most militant of the leaders, you know, who refused registration. So as a result of that, the registration hall was closed, and they were, you know, the charter was revoked, you know, so then they took a hall, you know, for the conference.
What consequences does having its charter revoked have for SDS on the Columbia campus?
Well, I think it makes them feel, you know, more militant, more angry, you know, and I think they're willing to struggle more now, you know, because it's just another thing added to the list of, you know, many things that have been, you know, done to them.
Will there be any practical consequences to SDS if it hasn't got a charter from the university?
Well, by practical, what do you mean? I don't.
In other words, does this destroy some of Columbia University SDS chapter's rights and privileges on the campus?
Well, legally, I mean, you know, as far as the, you know, the brass or the ruling class on a campus goes, you know, but as far as they don't matter anyway, because they're, you know, they're free to revoke whatever they want, whenever they want, you know. What really counts is the students and their attitude, you know, and I think they're going to be more militant, you know.
What does it mean legally? In other words, does this mean that if SDS chooses to hold a meeting anywhere on the campus, does that, and I don't know, I'm asking you, does that mean then that the university would be entitled to call on the police since they're not a chartered organization, legally chartered by the university?
Yeah, I think what they're doing is trying, you know, in essence really is making SDS illegal, you know, or they're trying to, you know, so that I guess anything that SDS wants to call within the campus, you know, they're going to meet with opposition, you know, and I don't know whether that necessarily means the cops are going to come in, but we've seen before that that's what it does mean, so I guess it'll happen again, you know.
Now, I feel that last spring they had legitimate issues, legitimate gripes, but once they got involved in the country club type affair in the buildings, it lost all perspective in regards to amnesty. It was their objective. Thank you. Which is a terrible thing. Now, over the summer, if you look back on it, it was very educational. It was did a great deal to change Columbia. They're in the process of change, but as you know, change won't come overnight. And I think what they're doing now is beating a dead horse in that they've done their thing. The mistakes have been brought to the fore, the troubles, the problems, and what they're doing now is senseless, is ridiculous. They're just pushing the administration to a point when they will have to make some completely definite stands, definite punishments. I'm sorry that the administration did grant amnesty to the majority of those involved last year, because I feel that this is making them look too weak. I can agree with their demonstrations because that's what they feel is right, I can't agree with their tactics in taking over buildings or disruptions. And what's that about? Sums it up.
We are in Carmen Hall right now, which is a dormitory composed almost completely of freshmen in Columbia College. In the basement of the dormitory, in a lounge, there is an SDS member talking with a number of students gathered there.
Are there really any changes between the Republican and Democratic administration? We heard students at that international conference, leftist students, revolutionary students, who 4 years ago were all working for the Labour Party in England. You know, and they really thought the Labour Party, once it got into power, would affect all these grand changes and affect some sort of democratic socialism in England. The Labour Party came to power, and as they said there, it was just 4 more years of Tory government. There's no difference between the political parties in the capitalist country. They're just there to keep people busy, to make them think that they have a chance to participate in the governing of society by voting, as all the McCarthy primaries prove that the people don't have a choice in the selection of their political candidate.
Okay.
And that's what we're fighting. And then tell me, well, what about the university? I'm concerned about my life when I get out of the university. I'm concerned about the society in which I have to live. The university is important. We're here now. We're trying to change the function. But you don't change the function of the university by saying, all right, before Kirk made all the decisions, now what we'll do is we'll have some students selected by some committees make the decisions and the faculty make the decisions. By the way, did you read the Pulse? Did you read Seymour Melman's proposal for restructuring the university? Faculty power, faculty. One demand after another. We struggled last spring to affect changes in this university, and the faculty was sitting on the fence. And now, when the power vacuum is created, Seymour Melman comes out, faculty power, faculty, faculty, faculty. They'll change the university for us. Now, see, I don't think it's a question of the structures that are set up to govern the university. What is important is what that university does, the content of that university. Now, I don't think that's amnesty. I don't even think that's partial amnesty. When all the people who were involved in the struggle are prevented from being involved in the struggle because they're faced with possibly being expelled from the university. So I don't think that's amnesty, you see. I don't think, for instance, that cutting institutional ties with IDA and letting professors continue the same weapons research that was going on before is breaking with IDA. I don't think that suspending gymnasium for 5 months until things calm down and then beginning it again, perhaps adding another 5% or 6% to the allotment for the community through the back door, is exceeding to our demand. So our simple demands from last year still haven't been met. And then you talk about grand restructuring proposals, a democratic university. Prove that this university is going to change by granting one simple demand. That's what we're asking the trustees to do. But you see, we're no longer talking about those demands now. We want more, because they prove that they're not going to move on these. Now we've got to show people how all the issues are linked. And I think that's what we're trying to do.
Okay, I would if you'll
allow a unradicalized freshman to get a word in edgewise. Most of them are liberal moderate.
To be cynical for a moment, you raised a lot of points there, and I certainly cannot answer all of them. I don't have that good a memory. But if I can take one of them at least and let someone else answer other points, you mentioned the point about, I think, fundamental about the fact that the political scene in this country does not differentiate between the two parties. The two parties are the same. They both have their conservative wings. They both have their liberal wings. You are implying that that's bad. And I'm just questioning that. Because part of the democratic experiment, it would seem, in this country, is the fact that there hasn't been any dramatic upheaval since the Civil War. You've had near upheavals, like, say, the populists in the 1890s, where the agrarian farmers wanted to shift the entire political scene leftward. They wanted silver in addition to gold. But the political system contained it, and the entire political spectrum shifted left a few steps. And what you want to do is to break out of the framework of this and to take the entire thing by the scruff of the neck and shift it left. Well, I think that within the two political parties, you can shift the entire thing. I think a good example is this year. McCarthy did not win. But I think that he has ended up in shifting the political spectrum left a bit.
He's probably shifted it.
Not right.
You've just heard one of the freshmen in Common Hall replying to Juan Gonzalez.
About your Mr. Belknap and how he spoke to you during the meeting. During the meeting, he was speaking to you as a friend, let's say. But when he was speaking to the reporters, he was speaking as representative of the university. And as representative of the university, he had to express the university's viewpoint. Also, you speak about Mr. Cordier being a negotiator. Well, I'm sure marching down to his house with 1,000 people, he's not going to negotiate right then. But if you and Mark Rudd and the other boys pick about five people to represent yourselves and call up his office and ask for an appointment, he would meet you.
He did it on Monday. He said he wasn't interested in our demands. Nobody ever made demands of him. In his years in the Congo and in France and in the United Kingdom and wherever he went, nobody ever made demands on him, and he's certainly not going to discuss demands. That's what he said. They're demands. Clearly, we make demands, we put them forth, and we say here.
Is there something about suggestions he likes?
Is it an ultimatum that you're giving him?
Why does that have to be a demand?
I have a strong suggestion.
The stop idea, if we say, please stop idea, I think that's silly.
Carry on, Doc.
Well, I think it's part of the political system. If you are basically accepting democracy, the American idea of democracy, then if you do not vote, then you are basically copping out. You just take the best that there is.
There's a difference, but it's very little difference. They're all for law and order. Wait one second. And another thing, I'm not clear. I have a question on the position of SDS. You had the student strike last year. You're very interested in the an overall change in the university and the society. But in general, do you want the university to remain open this year? Is that an objective, or is there an objective to close the university at all? You know, like, I'm not really clear on the position of SDS at all on that. You know?
Briefly, our position is that we have set forward certain demands which we think should be met. These are demands on three main issues, and everybody knows what they are, everybody knows the catchwords now. We think that it's imperative that these certain policies of the university be stopped. Now, we've done this for two main reasons, and I spoke about this last night. One is that we think that intrinsically these things are no good, like the racist expansion and what's going on with the work at the School of International Affairs. Intrinsically, we think those things are bad and very detrimental to the well-being of us, to our country, and to the people of the world. The second reason for this is because we feel that we would like to get our view across. We would like to other people. And this is what we call radicalization, or you can call it a lot of things. Some people have called it manipulation, but I tend to think it's not that at all, because we do it in such a way that people can make up their minds, and people can decide whether or not they're going to join a mass movement. So that there are these two reasons, and we want very much, we put forward these demands to win them so as to end these particular policies, and also so as to help build the radical movement. Now, as far as closing down the university, it's only a tactic.
Tactic, actually, or is it just incidental in the processes of trying to change this?
However, we could say, let's stop the university. That would be an end or a goal. And it's not, that's not our goal. Some people said, well, you're just out to destroy the university, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, there are some people, to be quite frank, there are some people in SDS who would like to stop the university, to stop it from functioning. And the way they get to that conclusion is they've decided that the basic function of the university in everything it does is only to aid a system that they believe is totally corrupt. And that includes the research, but it includes the basic function that we consider, you know, that touches us, namely what it does to us, this education, so-called educational function, which I and a number of other people in SDS feel is really to train us to fit slots. And this thing itself is intrinsically bad and should be stopped. However, I think that we would only want to do that if everyone in the university, most people, could come to this understanding. And what this would mean is that they would be totally anti-capitalist. You know? But what that would mean is, I think we have to talk more here about what this system is, what this system we call capitalism is, what the realities are. Now this guy, if I can just... Well, I hope I answered your question, but this guy said... he posed a problem. He says, we both look out on the world, he from a liberal position, from SRU, I from SDS, or SRU looks at the world, SDS looks at the world. And our conclusions are that, one, SDS believes revolution is necessary and possible. Possible, that's the word he used. And SRU's, or the liberal position, is revolution is impossible, but reform is possible. Now, I think the implication of what you said is that we both look out on the same reality, both look out on the same world, but our conclusions are different. But I think that is absolutely wrong. That we are looking at two different realities. That you have your own picture or image of reality, and I have another one. Now, according to a liberal view, or the academic freedom view, or the view that everybody believes, every individual has the absolute right to come along and choose which reality he's gonna see. Really what this does is, the word is reification. Reifies something which is concrete and makes it into an abstract. As if there are two abstracts, reality number one and reality number two. Liberal reality and a radical reality. In other words, what we see of what the world is like. But I think that ideas and the world is not really like a supermarket. It's not where we can go in and take our pick. But this concept of radical means, as if you remember what the German girl here last night was talking about, she said, we've got to get down to understand what reality is about, what the world is about. And when you understand it in its basic forms, down to its essentials, then you understand what radical means, which means down to the roots. And from there, we make our conclusions. So I really think that our two views of the world are very different because our conclusions are very different. Now, I'd like to be able to talk sometime now, later, whenever, about my view of the world, SDS's view of the world. It's not monolithic. It varies from individual to individual. And I'd like my friend from SRU to talk about his view of the world and why he believes reform is possible. But I think that's the essential difference. What is the world about? What is reality about? My view, I believe, of reality says that reform is not only possible, but it's necessary and inevitable. Or rather, excuse me, revolution is not only possible, but it's necessary and inevitable. And I think that his view is entirely, the conclusion is based on the view of reality.
First of all, I think we're all aware that for one objective reality existing, it does exist out there, but in our minds we only have various reflections of it. And an infinite number of facts to be known about the world, and we sort them into systems of ideas, ideologies, if you wish. And you happen to have a different view of the world.
Ideology is a separate word.
All right, very well. Very well.
Ideology has about six or seven...
We sort these ideas that come to us, which are different to begin with, we sort these into different patterns. These form our view of the world. Your pattern is that of a, let's say, a SDS revolutionary. Mine is that of a, all right, SRU reformist. This is too stereotyped. But you cannot simply say that I have the view of reality in capital letters and you do not have the view of reality. Because it is theoretically impossible for any human being to have a view of reality that corresponds to that out there in any different sense than just ordering the ideas and the notions that come to him into some ideological system. You cannot know reality in any more concrete sense than I can.
No, we applied two different methods. And what's important is to look at the methods of viewing reality. You tend to say it's totally relative to the observer. I say no, there is a reality out there.
I acknowledge that. I acknowledge
it is
that.
There. Let's apply the correct method now to look at that. And I think that there is a method which amounts to viewing the basic relations among human beings, the basic relations of human beings to their work.
In other words, you think that you've got a method to find absolute reality. Right?
Well, look, and now you can apply what
you've
not.
Got one ideological point of view, we've got another.
The purpose of this meeting is simply to have all the rest of the people here find out a little more of what their actual beliefs are in terms of life, and from there, in terms of revolution, the university, and the many issues we're talking about.
In stark contrast to the student voices, WBAI invited renowned author and Columbia University guest lecturer and philosopher Ayn Rand to record commentaries on the air. Here the author of Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead speaks for about a minute and a half, labeling the students as thugs, and yields over 20 minutes to her guest, Robert Hessen, an instructor at Columbia. Here is Ayn Rand.
The subject of today's discussion is Campus or Battleground? A report on the events of Columbia University in late April of 1968. In the summer of 1965, in my essay on the Cashing In, the Student Rebellion, which dealt with the first major explosion on a college campus at the University of California at Berkeley, I wrote that the main ideological purpose of the student rebellion was, quote, to condition the country to accept force as the means of settling political controversies. If the universities, the supposed citadels of reason, knowledge, scholarship, civilization, can be made to surrender to the rule of brute force, the rest of the country is cooked. Close quote. The rebellion at Columbia University is an eloquent illustration of my contention, of the purpose motivating the so-called student activists. To discuss it today, I have invited as my guest speaker Mr. Robert Hessen, who is a young instructor in Columbia University's Graduate School of Business and a candidate for a doctorate in the Department of History. His analysis of the student rebellion was published originally in Barron's magazine in late May and was subsequently reprinted in over 50 newspapers throughout the country. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Robert Hessen.
A larger-than-life portrait of Karl Marx dominated the entrance of a classroom building. A red flag flew from its rooftop. Chains barred the doors of other buildings, and chanting mobs roamed across the campus. The scene might have been the University of Havana, or Peking. It wasn't. It took place just a few express stops from Wall Street, at Columbia University, where, from April 23rd to 30th, student leftists seized and occupied five university buildings.
You know, I mean, I think revolution was, we turned revolution into a positive word, actually, because I think it was considered a pretty negative thing. I mean, there was the American Revolution, but all the other revolutions, like what was going on in Vietnam, were like communist-inspired and bad.
Cuba.
So there was a real, I think, shift in thinking of the Columbia students because we saw ourselves as part of a revolution. And, I mean, that was part of the radicalization, too, because a lot of us came into the buildings kind of as liberals and came out radicalized. So we came in wanting to reform and came out wanting to make revolution. And I'd say that my memory is that revolution was a pretty good thing up until sometime in the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, I didn't realize the revolution was going to happen until about 1982. I woke up one day and realized, oh, my God, this guy Ronald Reagan is president, and things have really changed. So I think that it's, I don't know exactly, you know, when it shifted, but I would say that for people on the left, revolution was a very positive word probably for a good 10 years after the strike.
You are listening to the sounds from the 1968 Columbia University Student Revolt on From the Vault. For a copy of this program or for information, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us at 1-800-735-0230. You can also visit our 1968 Preservation and Access Project at our home site, PacificaRadioArchives.org.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
1968, Revolution Rewind.
What you and I are for is freedom.
I hope you learned something from this.
Madam Nguyen Thi Binh, who today is the Vice President of the Socialist Republic of South Vietnam, was given voice on Pacifica Radio in 1966 when she was interviewed in Vienna after the International Women's Conference on the Welfare of Children. Broadcast in 1968, at the height of the violence in Vietnam, Pacifica reporter Madeline Duckles describes Madam Thi Binh, then member of the Central Committee of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, with reverence and respect.
They described their lives and the suffering of their people without polemics, and with quiet courage make clear their resolution to defend their country and to make it truly theirs for the Vietnamese people.
From 1954, faced to the policy of repression and terrorism by the Saigon administration, backed by the U.S. government, all the peoples of South Vietnamese people, from workers, peasants, to intellectuals, industrialists, to religious people, all have risen up to struggle against them.
This Revolution Rewind moment was made possible by the Pacifica Radio Archives with support from you, the Pacifica listener. To join the revolution, call us at 1-800-735-0230.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault, heard on the Pacifica Radio Network, with stations in Berkeley, Los Angeles, New York, Houston, and Washington, D.C., and over 125 affiliates nationwide. The series is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. We are now streaming and podcasting online at fromthevaultradio.org. For more information, call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening.